Nobody joins the Marine Corps for any other reason than really to be part of something bigger than just themselves. And it's really disheartening after serving for 17, 18, 19 years to finally figure out that you never fit in no matter how hard you tried.
That's Kate Germano. She led the military's only all-female battalion at Parris Island, where in 1 year she got dramatic results in recruit qualifications after decades of underperformance, and then she was fired. She'll talk about the challenges women face serving in the Corps. But first, another battle between California and the Trump administration. The EPA is planning to roll back federal fuel efficiency targets set during the Obama era. They argue the rules are too much of a burden on the auto industry. But California wants to keep those high standards. And some car makers say a rollback would hurt their business. Kara Horowitz is co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA School of Law. And welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why don't you briefly remind us of these Obama-era fuel efficiency guidelines that the agency now wants to roll back? What were they?
Sure. So the current rule set standards for greenhouse gas emissions and fuel economy from cars and light trucks. These are standards that are set nationally. They were developed with California, and they require pretty significantly cleaner and more fuel-efficient car fleets, and they run through 2025.
Okay, that's pretty straightforward. What's the administration's rationale for why they're not on board?
Well, the rule was, interestingly, the rule was reviewed by both California and the Obama administration just a couple years ago. Both of them found that the rule was still warranted and cost-effective, that it would save consumers money. But the Trump administration, maybe not surprisingly, is reversing course. It's taking a second look at the rule, especially as to model years 2021 through 2025. It's expected to announce that it wants to roll back the rule, and really I think it's making another kind of deregulatory pro-industry move here. It's going to talk, I'm sure, about burdens to industry. I think it's probably an added bonus that this move would offend and attack California, which seems to be a sport these days in the Trump administration.
Part of a trend. And we're still waiting on what the replacement rules would be, right?
Yeah, that's right. We just, you know, we believe that Scott Pruitt's going to make an announcement that that the review that the Trump administration is doing will result in a rollback, but we don't know how much of a rollback yet.
Now, under the Clean Air Act, California has this waiver from these federal mandates, and we've been able to set our own higher environmental standards, and that's how we've gotten here. And this, and other states have followed California's lead. But now, with Scott Pruitt saying that he's threatening to take that waiver away, what follows? Can he do that?
Yeah, so there are really two things at play here. First is EPA is very likely to roll back these federal standards. But then, as you say, California actually has special authority under the Clean Air Act to keep these rules in place through 2025. And so the big question, even bigger than will the federal standards be rolled back in some ways, is EPA going to try and undo California's special ability here to keep the rule in place through 2025? Many signs point to, you know, EPA potentially trying to undo this authority. If it does so, it would lead to a huge legal battle. California's authority has never before been revoked in quite this way by any EPA. It's really an attack on core state authority, and California will fight it tooth and nail.
Well, the attorney general here, Javier Becerra, has said the state, we just won't back down on higher fuel efficiency standards. In fact, he said we're prepared to take whatever action, legal or otherwise, that we must to protect our economy, our environment, and the public health of the people of California. What exactly is he saying, legal or otherwise? What cards does California have to play?
Yeah, well, you're right. California, there's no sign California is going to back down from these standards. They were sort of California's baby in a sense. California was the first ever state to move to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from cars. And it will argue legally that EPA can't revoke the waiver under the Clean Air Act, under statutory language. It'll also argue, I'm sure, that EPA hasn't justified doing so on the facts that EPA has marshaled. When it says legal and other, when Becerra talks about legal and other steps, I imagine he also has in mind fights outside the courtroom. So if, in fact, California were to lose its courtroom battle and lose the authority under the Clean Air Act, it'll probably have to get creative about how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector in other ways. There are lots of reasons to make cars less polluting, not just because of climate change. So I imagine it might start thinking about some of those other programs and rationales.
And before we move on to the question of car makers, what are California environmental players saying about what's at stake in keeping these emissions standards? And I'm not talking about end of the world scenarios, but maybe specifically what the consequences of rolling back the rules would be for the state of California.
Yeah, these are hugely important rules for California, both for meeting our state climate goals, which are very ambitious. California has pledged to reduce its climate pollution by 40% between 2020 and 2030, so in 10 short years, which is hard to do and is going to be very hard to do if it can't get these car standards in place or keep them in place. But it's also really important for tackling traditional air quality and air pollution. Transportation is the largest source of climate pollution in the state, and it also causes over half of emissions of ozone and particulate matter. So we're talking about huge effects here on human health, including asthma and strokes and heart attacks and lung disease. And so there's really a lot at stake for California communities.
I want to bring Aaron Robinson into the conversation. He's executive editor-at-large for Hagerty Magazine, an auto insurance publication. And I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Barbara.
Nice to see you again.
Yes.
Now, Scott Pruitt is positioning this potential rollback, as a win for automakers and also a boon for consumers in terms of low prices. But what is the auto industry's take on it?
Well, you have to understand that the auto industry is not speaking with one voice. Car companies said to the federal government, please slow it down because you're forcing us to build cars that the consumers don't want. Consumers want big SUVs. They want bigger vehicles. They're not so interested in, you know, with fuel prices being what they are, they're not so interested in these hyper-efficient or electric vehicles as the market bears out. The suppliers, on the other hand, are saying, no, you can't change this because we've spent invested huge fortunes in developing these technologies for what we thought was going to be this fuel economy standard. Don't change the standard. So the industry is really kind of divided. And in some respects, they've kind of unleashed their worst nightmare because what the auto industry fears above all is not higher standards. What they fear is a patchwork of standards. And if California decouples, as they're threatening to do, and nine states go with them, the nine states that follow California, the auto industry is now facing several markets in which they have to build compliance vehicles for, and that scares them more than anything.
The fracturing. And also, it takes years and years for them to catch up with any kind of pivot.
Right. And the other thing is that if the U.S. rolls back these standards, they will be an outlier among the rest of the world. If you take Asia and Europe, they're actually going forward on standards. The U.S. will fall back. That also scares the auto industry because what they would like to do is sell one car among three markets. But if those markets are doing different things, then that makes it much more expensive for them.
So car executives are going to meet with EPA Chief Scott Pruitt by early next week, I think, to talk about these possible new standards. What's that conversation going to sound like? What kind of deal do you think they're planning?
Well, of course, they're going to be very eager to see the plan since nobody that we know, we haven't seen the plan. We don't know what the EPA is proposing. And you have to remember that the EPA regulates greenhouse gases, but NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, they actually set the fuel economy standards. And they both have plans which nobody has seen yet. So we really don't know what we're going to get out of this yet. So I imagine the auto industry is going to go there and say, please give us some clarification, because these guys are making decisions for 5 and 10 years down the road, billion-dollar gambles, many billions of dollar gambles. They want to know what the future is going to look like.
What about the auto manufacturers, though, who have already been listening to consumers who are more fuel conscious and fuel efficiency standards conscious and want these fuel efficient cars? Haven't they already kind of taken the pulse of that market and begun catering to environmentally conscious consumers?
Yeah, I mean, engine sizes are dropping, curb weights are coming down. The auto industry is actually moving in the direction.
They could just ignore these a rollback.
Well, they could, but they won't. They'll give the consumers what they want. And you have to understand that as fuel economy standards rise, the car industry is getting very good at gaming the system. And this is totally legal, but there's a certain procedure under which cars are tested for fuel economy. And the engines that we're seeing now are very much designed to to pass that test. Now, once you get them out into the real world, because the test is not like the real world, once you get them out into the real world, they actually use more fuel. But these little 2-liter turbo engines that they're putting in SUVs, when they're on the test, the federal test procedure, they actually use quite a bit less fuel than when you get them out in the real world. Suddenly, they start making, they start using a lot more fuel. And so there's becoming a greater divide between the number that's on, printed on the window sticker and the real world economy that people are seeing. And so the auto industry is sensitive to that too, because the one thing they don't want to do is disappoint a lot of consumers with their actual real world fuel economy.
So a lot of slack, a lot of things in play here. Aaron Robinson, he's editor at large for Hagerty Magazine. Thank you so much for that.
Very happy to be here.
And we also heard from Kara Horowitz of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Thanks to you too.
Thanks, guys.
Coming up, we'll meet former Marine Corps officer Kate Germano. She led the military's only all-female recruit battalion, and in 1 year, she turned an underperforming group of women into qualified Marines, and then she got fired. Her story of gender bias in Marine training. That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Until 2015, Kate Germano led the military's only all-female recruit battalion. The 20-year career Marine and combat veteran was the commanding officer of the 4th Recruit Training Battalion in Parris Island, South Carolina, and then she was fired. Her commander cited abrasive commanding style, but she says that had more to do with her taking a stand and confronting gender bias and lowered expectations for women. The Marine Corps has the fewest women of all the branches of the military, and it continues to be the only one where men and women train separately. Now, Kate Germano has written a book about that. It's called Fight Like a Girl: The Truth Behind How Female Marines Are Trained. And she joins me now. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, and I hope you're well, and you tell a really interesting story.
Thank you.
One of the interesting parts of it is that one of the biggest complaints that you have about gender inequality in the Marines is this issue of separation, that male and female recruits train and live separately. So tell us about when you arrived at Parris Island. How were conditions and training different for women recruits compared to the men?
It's a great question. I can start by saying that the battalion is actually the only all-female unit in the entire Department of Defense. So the Marine Corps is the only service that has maintained segregated boot camp. And what that means is that the female recruits are separated both in time and space on the recruit depot. They're located in a very remote part of the base, close to family housing, where the other training battalions for the men are all sort of co-located, and they share consolidated academic facilities, dining halls, that kind of thing. So when I got to Parris Island, really, my predecessor had set the stage for me by saying, hey, you know, this place is unlike anywhere else in the Marine Corps. It's tears or cupcakes. The drill instructors are either going to be on your couch crying or they're going to be baking you cupcakes. And to me, that was astounding, because as Marines, we pride ourselves on being strong and being, you know, these warriors, and that didn't necessarily fit what I was used to in the rest of the Marine Corps.
Well, it sounds like as if it were a step back into the 1950s or something. There's a beauty salon for the women, right? And
right.
They have a tailor, and they have different food than the men. They're not allowed
yes.
to have cookies.
or sugar,
right.
Or salt.
They're not trusted to have sweets and make smart decisions. So essentially, the compound is self-sufficient. And as you mentioned, they have all of the things that a recruit would need, including a physical fitness field, classrooms, all of that stuff, all of the dining halls, it's right there. And so while that sounds great in theory, what that does is it doesn't allow the male recruits to see the women pushing themselves and excelling in training. And in my opinion, that just sets women up to fail in the rest of their time in the Marine Corps.
So this is a story about addressing what sounds like institutionalized bias.
Yes.
Which results in poor performance.
So absolutely.
The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, they all train male and female recruits together. Why do the Marines keep them separate? What's the rationale?
So one of the most disturbing things I found when I took command was that the 4th Battalion is used as a kind of a prop. So whenever there's a visit by a congressional delegation or a VIP, they would sort of trot out the female commander and talk about how great segregated training was. And the justification that I was given and that the Marine Corps still espouses today was that the only way you could create confidence in female recruits was by separating them. And when you looked at the data and you saw that for decades women had underperformed in every graduation category compared to their male counterparts, that didn't sit well with me, because basically what that was saying was we think segregation is the only way to create confidence in these women, but that's not being borne out by the scores.
Okay, so this is what you found when you arrived, and then you set out to make changes, and you wrote a confidence pact, and you had these new teaching methods on the firing range that you were describing, and stretching and yoga. Even better food and marching to the range, more marching and marching. What results did you get with these changes?
We found that the women absolutely blew the doors off of the rifle range for the first time in Marine Corps history. We found that they were more confident. It was absolutely noticeable in the way that they carried themselves. They were performing better in practical application scenarios. They were stepping up into leadership roles. So it was a much different dynamic. As opposed to when I got there, where it was a very, very much a status quo, just all we need you to do is pass, and that's all, you know, all we can expect.
Now, you charge that the Marines don't want women recruits to do better, mm-hmm. and that they didn't appreciate your efforts and those results that you stated for us. But why would that be? Because women are now serving in battle alongside men, and as I understand it, I don't have a military background, but you're only as good as the weakest link in battle.
That's
right?
Absolutely right.
So
absolutely
why
right.
not have better trained troops of both genders?
Well, that was my whole point. And I assumed that the rest of the Marine Corps would also think it would be good if the women were stronger, faster, and tougher. What I ended up finding out was that there was a lot of resistance to that, because it ended up threatening sort of the idea that only male Marines can do certain functions in the Marine Corps. So the other thing that I found that was quite interesting was that historically, the Marine Corps has always been the most resistant of all of the services to change. So when we integrated African Americans into regular units, there was a hue and cry from the Marine Corps about how it was going to destroy cohesion and cause death on the battlefield. Same thing happened with the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and allowing gays to serve openly in the military. Well, the same arguments have been used by the Marine Corps to prevent women from going into these new roles in ground combat.
Well, what kind of resistance did you face?
I faced tremendous resistance. I mean, first and foremost, I think the thing that's most important for me to explain is that I face the double bind that women in the corporate sector face, where we say that all of these leadership characteristics are prized, but the reality is that when a woman is a strong leader and is aggressive and is a go-getter, they're not perceived the same way that their male counterparts are. So I think it's really important that women in the corporate sector and other areas of the economy understand that we all share these same challenges, because that was exactly what I found at Paris Island.
Are you talking about this charge that when a man is forceful, he's seen as a leader, and when a woman's forceful,
yes.
she's seen as a bitch?
Absolutely. And that was exactly the reaction that I got. I had experienced that elsewhere in my 20 years in the Marine Corps, but I really wanted to believe that I fit. Nobody joins the Marine Corps for any other reason than really to be part of something bigger than just themselves. And it's really disheartening after serving for 17, 18, 19 years to finally figure out that you never fit in no matter how hard you tried. So I met with significant resistance on the recruit depot and really throughout the highest levels of the Marine Corps in terms of what we were trying to do. And instead of being perceived as a strong go-getter, I was perceived by the leadership as being mean and abusive.
Another side of the story is, and the numbers bear this out, the Marines have the highest rate of sexual harassment
Yes.
of all the armed services. And it's estimated that nearly one in three women in the Marines have experienced sexual harassment at work. What did you encounter coming up in the Corps and at Parris Island that contributes to your argument about gender bias in the Marines and why it's so endemic?
My biggest failing in my 20 years in the Marine Corps, and the thing that I am most ashamed about, is that I was one of those women who could run fast, knew my job down pat, and was seen as a strong person. And so I, just like a lot of women in the Marines, I distanced myself from other women who might be perceived as less strong. I wanted to think that I was the exception to the rule.
I mean, you were one of the guys.
Exactly. But I was never one of the guys. And so my biggest regret is knowing that I let all of those women behind me down because I wasn't willing to get to them and say, hey, you know what? I saw you do this. This is awesome. But you really need to take a look at this and I can help you get there. Instead, a lot of women in the Marines, because there are so few of us and it's dog eat dog, we distance ourselves from those women who are struggling just because we don't want to be associated with them. And that's a horrible way to have Lance Corporals carry the weight of gender bias in the Marine Corps on their shoulders.
You also admit that when one of your own charges under your command came to you with a report of ongoing sexual harassment, you didn't see it.
That's right. And I, you know, it's funny. She had the courage to tell me that story. And I was devastated because she was one of my best Marines. And we are in touch to this day. And I'm super proud of her. She was a student at the Georgetown Law School. But the reality was that I didn't see it because I didn't want to see it. And when I got to Parris Island, it was so in my face that it no longer became something that I could deny. And when I reflect back on my career, my husband and I talk about this a lot, I can pick out times where I experienced harassment, where I was retaliated against, where I was, you know, even groped. And I never wanted to acknowledge that. And so I forced the women who were junior to me to carry that weight all by themselves. And I'm completely ashamed by that.
So you did, though, put all of these changes in place in the face of resistance, and you got these great performance results mm-hmm. with women recruits at Parris Island, and then you got fired.
Yes.
On what grounds did the Marines claim they fired you?
They very publicly said that I had been abusive to my Marines because I had higher standards. So it was really, really a difficult time where I wasn't even willing to walk the tightrope. I just wanted to be strong and make sure that these women were as tough and fast, as strong as they could be. The male leadership seems to believe that the only way we got the results we did was because I dragged the Marines kicking and screaming across the line. But anybody who's studied organizational success knows that that can't be possible.
So you see your firing as a case of bias and a kind of referendum on your performance based on that bias. But were there other factors of retaliation or again, this resistance to the changes that you were trying to make?
Well, I mean, the fact that I had women in the battalion who didn't agree with my leadership style and had the ability to go behind me to complain to my commander made it much more difficult to defend myself. So I was meeting with resistance not only from the men on the depot, but also from some of the women within my own battalion.
You also, though, had written an article about the performance
Yes.
results that you were able to achieve, and that seemed
Yes.
to rile your commanders.
So I think that the article I wrote really was the last straw for the leadership. And that article went all the way up to the Commandant of the Marine Corps. It's highly unusual that the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the leader of all the Marines, he's like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. It's highly unusual that he would be briefed on one single Lieutenant Colonel Battalion Commander.
On the other hand, weren't you facing, though, backlash and backtalk from people who feel that you're maligning the Marines?
Every day. I mean, the trolls are out. And all I can say is that if you just take me out of the mix, if you want to insist that I was the problem personally, if you take me out of the mix, the issues are still there. Gender bias, sexual harassment, sexual assault, and retaliation are still faced by thousands of Marine women every year.
really enlightening window into the Marines. I want to thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kate Germano, she's co-written a book with Kelly Kennedy called Fight Like a Girl, The Truth Behind How Female Marines Are Trained. It's coming out next week. Coming up, a look at some of this week's new movies, including Ready Player One, a dystopian sci-fi sprinkled with a little social commentary.
He's being opposed by the evil corporate half of Steve Jobs, who wants to sell ads into space, and that's like the worst possible thing they can do. They also murder people, but ads are seen as the greater evil in this universe.
Our film critics are here next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven from Madeline Brand, and it's time for Friday Films. I am so glad, and I'm also so glad that Alicia Malone is with us. Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
She's the host of Turner Classic Movies and the Filmstruck podcast. And Whitney Seibold is here as well. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Whitney contributes to IGN and hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Let us start with this huge blockbuster released this week, Ready Player One. This is the new film from Steven Spielberg, and it's set in a kind of dystopian future. Let's hear a clip.
Sitting here in my tiny corner of nowhere, there's nowhere left to go. Nowhere. Except the Oasis. A whole virtual universe.
A whole virtual universe. Is that what this is about? This story takes place in 2045, right? And the world is in ruins. And is the idea that people escape into the Oasis?
The Oasis is, it's sort of like a combination virtual reality video game slash social network. And it's the only thing anybody ever does in the future anymore. I guess you can make money in the Oasis because that's all people seem to do, and they're all concerned with the power-ups they buy in this video game, the things they can do to enhance their video game. We don't really see too much of the outside world except to see that the streets are littered with trash.
And these very cool container buildings that everyone lives in, the cliffs.
They live in something called the Stacks, which is,
right.
Just pretty much RVs stacked up on top of one another. The plot involves a young man named Wade who... his ultimate goal is to beat the game. He's being opposed by the evil corporate half of Steve Jobs, who wants to sell ads into space, and that's like the worst possible thing they can do. They also murder people, but ads are seen as the greater evil in this universe.
There's an argument to be made there.
I suppose so.
I guess. I think it all begs this question, and maybe Alicia, you can handle this, whether Spielberg pulls off a movie about the grand themes of gaming, right? Like, can he get inside that mindset enough to grapple with all of these issues that Whitney, you just mentioned, and that the book gets into, really, about freedom and the corrosiveness of the virtual world as well?
No. But it's fun. It's a fun movie. It's filled with a lot of pop culture references. So the book focused mainly on the 80s, but here you get a mishmash. You get nods to Michael Jackson and Saturday Night Fever and The Shining and even Jurassic Park. Spielberg, you know, references himself. And the action sequences, which take place inside virtual reality, reality, which most of the movie takes place inside of, are very thrilling and very Spielbergian, and he definitely knows how to block action in a way that you can follow it, and it's very exciting. It didn't have anything to say. I feel like the book, as escapist and fun and silly as the book was, it did have
it
more
had
meat
ideas.
To it. Ideas of, firstly, you know, what happens to this world? You know, why is it so dystopian? Secondly, what happens to people when they spend all their time inside virtual reality? Yeah. And thirdly, even the character development for the character of Wade, going from a geek in real life, hero in the game, to being a hero in real life and the game, felt like it was completely slashed. I felt like this film had so much more character development that was filmed, and then it was all edited out just to be the game.
There's no irony here. There's no commentary here. There's no actual human life in here. It's just kind of a big bouillabaisse of, I like the Iron Giant, I like Hello Kitty, and I can spot those things.
Okay, maybe a movie for Spielberg fans.
Yeah, and gamers.
A little older.
Gamers.
Moving on to a very different film. It's called Acrimony, and it stars Taraji P. Henson as a wronged woman seeking revenge.
Every time a black woman gets mad, she's a stereotype. Sick and tired of hearing that. You still messing around with her?
I'm Diana. Robert's fiance.
Maybe he did mean what he said. Maybe the deceit isn't what you think.
Oh, no. I don't think so.
Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. Whitney, you saw this. She says she doesn't want to be a stereotype of an angry black woman here. Taraji doesn't, but does she succeed?
Well, when you go to see a movie about a wronged Taraji P. Henson, you want to see her get angry.
I know, that's
you want
why
to,
I'm
you
in
want
those
to see
seats.
Those scenes where she just sort of starts pounding her fists against the man who wronged her. This is actually kind of a careful soap opera, despite the way it's been handled in the marketing, where we kind of trace her relationship with her husband, where how she met this man in college.
What? I thought this was a Fatal Attraction redo. You're saying it's a soap opera?
It's kind of a soap opera. And it's about how she feels she was wronged and whether or not she actually was and how much of her anger is justified. She marries this young man straight out of college. He was always waving red flags. He had an affair early on, but he tried to redeem himself. But he kept on draining money out of her. It turns out she was independently wealthy. And it was about how his success in the future was contingent on her suffering throughout their past. And then they get a divorce, and then he's successful. And now she feels that she's been wronged by this. What we want to see in this movie is Taraji P. Henson going all Taraji P. Henson on this guy. And there is a fantastic climax where such things do happen that feels like something out of Tales from the Crypt. Getting up to that point...
Sounds like a mishmash of movies going on.
This is a Tyler Perry film, and he's always had sort of mixed messages. He's always trying to tell these really sort of wholesome messages with good lessons, but at the same time, he moralizes very aggressively. I can't tell if Tyler Perry wants us to sympathize with Taraji P. Henson or not, because the man who does the wronging might be a redeemable character. So this could be seen as moral ambivalence, or it could be seen as Tyler Perry not quite making up his mind.
So mixed messages here, but Tyler Perry's movies, they bring in so much money. Just look at the Madea franchise.
They bring in a lot of money, and they are in this sort of really boldly melodramatic, cheesy level, are just barely entertaining. They're not necessarily good.
Oh, and damning with bait praise.
And even though Tyler Perry has made many films at this point, he's still kind of figuring out how to make a film look like a real film. They still look like big TV productions. This one, you know, he's still sort of easing into it. There's a lot of green screen effects. Everything looks really amateurish. It's Taraji P. Henson who's really holding everything together right at the center there.
Well, let's take a sharp turn into a film that looks very much like a film, and an indie film at that. It's called Outside In. It's from the indie director Lynn Shelton, and it stars Jay Duplass as a man who was recently released from prison thanks to the help of his former high school teacher, played by Edie Falco. Let's take a listen.
I just want a simple life. Come home every day to somebody that I love and be good to them. I want you.
Chris, I have to save my marriage. Oh my God. Tom, we can be friends.
We're not friends. You're the only person I can talk to.
You're everything to me.
Now, is this a movie about what it's like to re-enter life after prison, or is it an unlikely romance?
A bit of both. Yeah, it explores both things, and I think this is the best I've ever seen Jay Duplass as an actor, because he's mainly known as a filmmaker, and he's part of what they call the mumblecore movement, which they put Lynn Shelton into, which is people that made films that were very improvised and independently made. This one's scripted. In fact, they both wrote it together, but it has a lot of that same naturalistic, authentic feel. Edie Falco is wonderful, and I love that she is not overly glamorous. She looks like someone who lives in this struggling town in Washington. The relationship between Jay and Edie's characters, very elegantly done, and it's just a very simple, moving, effective story. What I liked about it is it's the kind of movie that doesn't reveal everything straight away. You slowly piece together why he was in prison, how he's having trouble getting back into his life, and their relationship together, and it all just unfolds very nicely.
I was going to ask you that, though, about the acting and the casting, because I would believe Edie Falco in any role, but
yes.
But Jay Duplass, we know him from Transparent, we know mm-hmm. him from comedies, and from behind the camera, and I just can't really picture him as an ex-con.
Yeah, I mean, the story, you know, the places the story goes, he is a believable character in that respect. And like I said, I think he does such a great job. He goes to some emotional places that we haven't seen him go to before. And he's kind of guy that holds everything in. So you see a lot of what he's going through on his face. And I love that. I love watching interesting faces on screen.
So is there actually a romantic spark between these two actors?
Yeah, I love the chemistry between them. They definitely play off each other really well. And it's very well done, the older woman, younger man relationship, which we don't see very often. And we also don't see many characters like Edie Falco's characters on screen. A woman over her 40s who, you know, doesn't have time to do her makeup and look in the mirror, and she's just trying to get through her life. So it's very well done. I liked this one.
Well, great. And last but not least, Gemini.
You know how you were saying you don't feel safe? I feel like that all the time. Am I under arrest?
Not yet.
Creepy. But, you know, judging from the trailer, when I saw this in the cinema, Los Angeles seemed to be the star of the movie. It's like this L.A. neo-noir kind of vibe.
It is taking a lot of cues from L.A. noir, even though it has sort of a dreamy hip-hop, sort of trip-hop soundtrack and tone. It does bend really hard into noir territory. In fact, there's a scene about two-thirds of the way through the film when somebody's sneaking through a house looking for clues. She wanders into a room that, for no reason whatsoever, has an old 1940s noir film projected on the wall above her, signaling to the audience, yes, this is the territory we're in.
And what's it about?
It's about a young movie star played by Zoe Kravitz and her personal assistant, who's played by Lola Kirk, and their relationship, how they pretty much have a friendship for hire relationship. They're very good friends. They're very close, but she's also working for Zoe Kravitz, and how Zoe Kravitz is about to tip into some sort of unnamed scandal that is potentially disastrous for both of them. But she also has to look over her mental health as well and make sure that this sort of shallow movie star character is also really feeling good about herself. A gun gets involved early on, and we all know from Chekhov, you have to fire that gun eventually. And it does eventually sort of tip into noir, but I think the entire point of the film is the friendship between these two women and the love they feel for one another, and how in Los Angeles that artificial type of friendship for hire has dubious amounts of authenticity attached to it.
Wow, this is much deeper than I thought this film would go. And yeah. And I should ask you this, Alicia. It's a movie about two women, but it's made by a male director. And mm-hmm. so that does raise this male gaze question. Does it read like a male fantasy of a femme fatale noir, or it sounds more evolved than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think it is more evolved. I think at times it's more of a fantasy of a noir film, and in that it tries to add shadows to the perpetually sunny LA and the seediness to the glamorous Hollywood life. But I agree, at its core, it is about this female friendship and this relationship and the back and forth between them. And that's what I found really interesting. Lola Kirk, I think, is an underrated actress.
She's fantastic. She's from Mozart in the Jungle.
Yes.
She's the lead there.
And she's so captivating to watch. John Cho is in the film as well. He plays the detective. And I just love the mood of the film. It's the kind of movie that stayed with me for a long time. And yes, the plot does get a little bit convoluted and a bit unwieldy in terms of what is happening between these characters. But at its heart, that relationship piece, I thought that was really interesting.
Well, great, great film to end on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Whitney Seibold, he contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed, and Alicia Malone, host of Turner Classic Movies and the Filmstruck podcast, and our Friday regulars. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk sports, and you know that's a very exciting topic for Jason Sklar. So stay tuned for our regular Friday Sports Talk coming up on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
And you know what that means. Time now to talk about sports, and there's a lot to talk about. The NCAA men's basketball tournament is on, with the Final Four facing off tomorrow. Will this year's Cinderella, Loyola Chicago, advance, taking their adorable cheering nun to Monday's final game? And in baseball, the Dodgers and Angels both stumbled out of the gate in opening night action. Plus, as the NBA's regular season nears its end, the Lakers are out of playoff contention, but the Clippers are still in the running. A lot going on in the wide world of Southland sports. So we turn now, of course, to one half of the comedy team, the Sklar brothers. Jason Sklar, it is so good to see you.
Good to see you too, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know I always want to start with baseball. So
let's start with baseball.
My sport. And opening day yesterday, well, a little difficult for the Dodgers versus the Giants in opening night action.
I get to do my dad's old bad joke that they're not going to be able to sell beer at Dodger Stadium. You know why?
No, why, Dad?
They lost the opener.
Arr.
Folks,
it was
a rough one, and you know Clayton Kershaw pitched great, but then he did the most Clayton Kershaw thing ever and give up a weird home run in the middle innings.
The only run of the game. Yeah.
And you know the Giants have a sort of decimated bullpen, yet they held it together and they shut out the Dodgers, which to me is maybe more of a concern than Clayton Kershaw. Clayton Kershaw will win his games this year. He looked great last night. He just made one mistake.
We will hold you to this pronouncement.
Well, the things that the Dodgers need to work on is Cody Bellinger came up with two outs with runners in scoring position and struck out again on a breaking ball. Cody Bellinger, you know, he came into the league last year on fire. And some people say, well, pitchers didn't know him yet. They didn't know how to scout him and how to pitch to him. By the time the playoffs and the World Series came around, pitchers started to learn like how to get him out, which was breaking balls inside and low. And he still hasn't quite figured out how to make that transition to be able to hit that pitch. As soon as he hits that pitch, he's going to be one of the most dangerous hitters in the league, but he's not quite there yet. And the Dodgers should have a little bit of concern about that. The fact they couldn't generate one run against the Giants, you know, obviously, we're not saying the sky is falling. No one's going to go 162
and 0. It's just the first day. Yeah.
However, it was that moment, you know, opening day you kind of like to go out, especially when you went to the World Series last year. And the Dodgers are definitely in the mix. They're about five or six teams this year.
But people must have been thinking about omens, you know, baseball. So superstitious.
It really
and here
is.
They had a flood, at Dodger Stadium on opening day.
On Tuesday. It was the final day of the exhibition play preseason, and sewage started, you know, garbage started, you know, flowing onto the field, and they fixed it. They took care of everything. But then, you know, I told someone there was like sewage and disgusting stuff on the field. And someone said, are you talking about Tuesday night or the Dodgers on Thursday night and they're hitting?
Ouch.
I was like, it was Tuesday night. The Angels also lost, which was a bummer, but exciting in some ways. The Angels made some good acquisitions. Upton putting him on the team. Mike Trout is back. Mike Trout, by the way, might be the most under the radar best player in Major League Baseball. Before he got hurt last year, before he hurt his thumb, he was on fire. You know, there's a stat in baseball called wins above replacement. And that's where they sort of figure, like, if you're out, how many wins would you have gotten over the guy who's replacing you? It's a really wonderful new stat. And this guy was at like 7.8, 7.9, which is higher than any other player in history. He's an unbelievable player. He hits home runs. He steals bases. He's an amazing fielder. Mike Trout, remember that name.
I thought you were going to talk about Shohei Ohtani.
You know, he's...
This is Babe Ruth. Commodity from Japan and kind of this all-around Swiss Army knife of a player. He can pitch with both hands, allegedly,
and
right?
And he can pitch and he can hit. They used him as a DH. Again, he was a guy who they found out kind of this year in spring training, he can't really hit a major league curveball. He can hit the fastball, but he can't really hit the curveball. So pitchers are starting to understand how to pitch to him as well. And, you know, he got a hit in his first time up, 1-for-5. Didn't do great. Didn't do badly. He's going to pitch on Sunday. I think we have to temper our expectations about him. He might not be like the Japanese Babe Ruth. He might be the Japanese Babe Diedrichsen, which is also great.
Which is fine. Right. And we got to move on to basketball. But I have to say, I was really intrigued by this story about the first pitch to the Cubs by the Miami Marlins. Cubs. The batter hits a home run right off the bat. My husband timed it. It took the Marlins 7 seconds to begin losing.
You know, the Marlins are really an organization. You're like, what are you doing? To me, I think the Marlins should take the best players from Cuba and then be like, that's our team. That would be better than what they're doing right now.
Oh, brilliant.
They've had a fire sale. They got rid of Giancarlo Stanton. They've gotten rid of everyone. And you're like, how are you going to get people to pay to come to your games? I don't know. Rough.
Okay, let's move on to what some people think of as the big story right now. Why aren't we talking about it? March Madness. Final Four
you
closes
about,
out
yeah,
Saturday and Monday.
Loyola
right?
of Chicago, mm-hmm. the Cinderella still in the dance. They have Sister Jean, a 98-year-old nun, who is kind of the spirit guide of this whole tournament. She's the star of the tournament. Everyone loves her. Mm-hmm. They're playing Michigan. Jalen Rose, who was part of the Fab Five, his grandmother, his 100-year-old grandmother, called out Sister Jean.
It's a battle of the grandmas.
Yeah. We have like 100-year-old like female beef going on between these ladies. No, Sister Jean is a wonderful woman. As a Michigan graduate, I do want to see Michigan beat them so badly that she becomes an atheist. That's just my hope.
Aiming high.
But she's
Villanova versus Kansas, too.
You know, all the experts are picking whoever wins that game to win the whole tournament. Yeah. Don't sleep on Michigan or Loyola. Those are great teams.
So that's where your heart is.
Obviously, yeah. But I think, you know, that's going to be a great game. Villanova, Kansas is going to be an amazing game. Michigan, Loyola is going to be a great game. They both play the same kind of style. It's exciting. Well, it's a very exciting time. You know, they're saying that Coach Beilein of Michigan is the cleanest coach in all of college basketball, voted by his peers. So what they're saying is it's a matchup of Mr. Clean versus Sister Jean. Who's going to win?
Mr. Clean, what does that even mean?
He's the cleanest coach. He runs a very clean program. And that's, you know, at this time, with the FBI investigating a lot of college programs, that is a big source of pride for Michigan and Coach Beilein. He did it. He got there the right way. And it's interesting to see, you know, his team has a lot of seniors and juniors. These are kids who weren't five-star recruits. They were lower, under-the-radar kids that he coached up and brought a team concept. And the same thing with Loyola. So it's exciting.
Well, meanwhile, the Clippers are still, are they marginally, is that right to say, in the playoff hunt? Do you think they'll make a push in these final games?
They're a game and a half back from Minnesota, and they've had some quality wins recently. You know, they beat Milwaukee, which is a good team, came back and beat them. They also beat Toronto, which is probably the best team in the East. So they've been doing well, and you know who's been doing really well, which is surprising, is Austin Rivers, son of the coach Doc Rivers. A lot of people are like, this is nepotism on parade. Mm. The coach he runs basketball operations for the Clippers, gave his son a great contract, and everyone was like, well, obviously, you did it for your kid.
He didn't deserve it?
People are saying no, but now guys have gotten hurt, and he's had to step up, and he's emerging as a really good player, and it's kind of exciting for Clippers fans.
Well, tell us, look back, what's your favorite kind of maybe a little bit off the news sports story, and looking forward?
From this Pat, mm-hmm. the first round of the tournament, a 16 seed beating a 1 seed, Virginia losing to UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I thought I would never see a 1 seed lose to a 16 seed in my lifetime, and we saw it. And they're retrievers. Their mascot is a golden retriever, or not really a golden retriever, but a retriever. That is, to me, one of the most beautiful, greatest moments in sports. I loved it. And I love Michigan's last second shot by Jordan Poole to beat Houston. And then Mo Wagner on Michigan, the German player who plays for Michigan, as they were running around the court, he stopped and found a Houston player and put his arm around him and told him it was going to be okay. It was one of the best moments of sportsmanship in the entire tournament. And that was a great moment. It touched my heart. It was a beautiful moment for basketball. Looking forward, Final Four. It's going to be amazing.
Sweet. Thank you so much for this. It was so
Thank
fun.
You.
Thank you. Jason Sklar, one half of the Sklar Brothers and a regular here on Press Play. Thanks again. And that's it for us for this week. Our show was directed by Michelle Alloy and Sarah Sweeney. Our producers are Amy Todd, Gina Pollack, Yale Evan Orr, Devin Schwartz, and Jenna Cagle. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards engineered. Madeline Brand, she'll be back on Monday. I'm Barbara Bogave. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend, everybody.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.